we've been together now for a day, just one single day in each other's company. It might feel like an awful lot longer, 5 or 6 weeks maybe. But 24 hours have passed since the retreat was launched yesterday. And it's time to reflect, to consider some of the aspects of the teaching and the practice. One of the things I'd like to underscore, to emphasize, something I said last night and referred to during today, is the encouragement to set the intention to learn from everything that happens. I said this yesterday, and you think, well, he already went through that. I know that. But what happens for all of us is that there are certain things that arise that we realize, oh, okay, this is a useful learning opportunity. They may be the mind wanders off into remembering things that happened last week, or some kind of struggle you had on the way here, getting lost on the way to Amravati, being told by your GPS to go to a farm up the A4146. People often get sent to by their GPSs. Or the mind wandering off to plan what we're going to do after the retreat is over. And then we notice, oh yes, that's the mind getting distracted. Okay, let go of that. And then come back to the present. Very good. And so we can take certain aspects of our experience as good learning, good practice opportunities. But then other things wade in, like annoying pain in our knee, or somebody that we're sharing the room with who has a very pronounced snoring capacity. And then somehow that doesn't get included. That's not an interesting thing to learn from. That's a problem. Yeah, and we're often completely unconscious of this, how the mind sets things up in this way. And we don't notice. So it gets registered as, oh, this really is a problem. I've got an issue with my knee. Well, yeah, but he really is snoring a lot. It is a problem. And so the mind sort of frames it or categorizes it in a different way. And then we start to worry about it. We feel a reasonable annoyance with that person. You know, that bloke who's snoring, or you know, that woman who breathes in a really upsetting way, or was putting her belongings in the wrong place. And the mind moves towards a reasonable aversion. We got a good list of justification for our being upset or irritated, and that being wrong, it shouldn't be this way, or that this particular ailment, this headache, this pain in the knee, or a strange feeling in the gut, whatever it might be. We probably each have our own particular choice items in this category. But we fail to see that you know, this too is included, or can be included if we're wise. So that's the first encouragement I'd like to give, is to broaden the field, to really notice where the mind says, no, this is a genuine problem, and it's my responsibility to worry about it. Yeah, it's my, I should get upset. I mean, it is a problem. It shouldn't be this way. And to notice that, to pick that up, and then to broaden the scope and to include this within the field of what we learn from, what is, say, a source of wisdom. And that readiness to include even things which are completely unlikable, like if you've had a headache ever since you've arrived here, or before you arrived here, you've got an ongoing, you know, dreadful headache, or some kind of family crisis that chose to happen, you know, half a day before you left to come here. And the challenge is to have a quality, to cultivate a quality of acceptance, of accommodation, to bring that in and say, oh, what's this teaching me? This particular issue, some member of our family decides that they are that we've done something terribly wrong and hurtful to them, or head is aching viciously. We've got a strange, painful, gnawing ache in our leg. Whatever it might be. Now, when I was talking about loving kindness and non-contention as a fundamental attitude, this is, in a way, this is how we broaden the scope, how we bring things in, is to consciously cultivate this attitude of loving kindness, of non-contention. In this, it's very helpful to understand what we mean by loving kindness. And this is a theme that Lumpur Sumedha would often address. When we use the word love, metta, loving kindness, he would point out that we often mistake that for trying to make ourselves like everything. If you had a headache for 3 days, it's not very likable. If one of your children has just chosen to say, you know, you've ruined my life, you're the worst thing that's ever happened to me, you're the most dreadful parent, you know, I'll hate you forever, have a nice retreat. then you can't like that. It's not a likable thing. It's not something that we can pretend is sweet. Oh, how marvelous. We might sort of try and sugar it over. Oh, what a wonderful learning opportunity. You know, I found this extremely helpful, and Lumpur would point this out. So there are certain things in life which are not likable. And if we try to pretend or force ourselves to like them, then we end up in this strange sort of hypocritical idealistic position, trying to make ourselves like the unlikable. But as he would say over and over again, liking is not the same as loving. And when we talk about developing loving kindness, the phrase he would use was not dwelling in aversion, finding that place in our heart which is not finding fault with even the most painful or difficult, the chronic damage in our knee, or the 3-day headache, or the family crisis, or whatever that might present itself in that way. That even though we can't like it, we can, without any hypocrisy or without any kind of sugaring things over or pretense, we can find a place in our heart where we're not resenting it, we're not contending against it. We're not pretending that the bitter is sweet, but we're recognizing bitterness happens in the world. There are some tastes, some things are bitter, and that's part of the mix. I also like the phrase radical acceptance. So there's a recognition that bitterness belongs. You know, if you have a head and it has nerve endings in it, every so often you'll get a headache. Well, exactly why you get a headache, or what causes it, and how long it's going to go on is perhaps mysterious. We don't know. We can't figure that out. But we're not going to pretend that we're glad that it's been going on. But we can recognize whatever the causes are, here it is. This pain in my head, or this family difficulty, or this issue that's appeared within my world. Here it is, like it or dislike it. Here it is, and that quality of acceptance, of recognizing that everything belongs. The beautiful and helpful and noble belongs, and also that the painful, the conflicted, the spiteful, the violent, it all belongs. It's all part of the mix. You're not pretending that it's all enjoyable, or that it's all wholesome, or all beneficial, but we're recognizing that there is this whole array of experiences within what is possible for us as human beings. So when we understand metta, loving kindness, in this way, it changes the tone somewhat. But I feel this is really a beautiful and helpful teaching. And the Buddha was a genius at coming up with very graphic examples or images, similes that would really sort of stick in your mind. And in talking about the need to develop this quality of kindness, of radical acceptance, and how important it is to not dwell in aversion. How if the mind is dwelling in aversion, if the mind sort of conjures up a reasonable hatred, that there's some kind of justifiable spite or resentment, that is something that is intrinsically out of harmony with Dhamma. The Buddha came up with what's called the simile of the saw. This is in one of the discourses in the middle length sayings, the middle length discourses, Majjhima Nikaya. And he said, if you were kidnapped, if you'd been abducted by bandits, and they were sawing your arms and legs off with a two-handled saw, this gets our attention, doesn't it? So you've been kidnapped, and you're being delimbed by these bandits, sawing your arms and legs off with a two-handled saw. And he said, if you gave, one who gives rise to or dwells in a thought of negativity towards those people, on account of that, they are not fulfilling my teaching. They're not acting in accordance with Dhamma. So you think it would be reasonable, I mean, justifiable to have a teensy bit of resentment, to being treated so badly, so violently, and so unjustly. But the Buddha is using this deliberately extreme example where a part of us would say, well, of course you're going to resent it and hate it, and you're going to feel negative towards them. And certainly painful feelings are going to arise, and there might be waves of fear and negativity. But the mind that buys into that and takes hold of this and says it shouldn't be this way, and these people are to be hated. So even in an extreme situation like that, to take hold of that feeling and identify with it intrinsically brings us out of harmony with reality. And he says, rather you should spread loving kindness towards them. To those who are cutting your arms and legs off. I will abide pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, free from hatred and ill will. So that sets the bar pretty high. But as I said, the Buddha was brilliant at getting our attention. And I feel that's it's a useful teaching, a powerful and a useful teaching, because when we have that gnawing sensation in our knee, we're not actually being delimbed. When we have a long-lasting headache, or we have a tension between ourselves and the person that we're sharing a room with, or the person next door to us in the dormitory, then you can notice those feelings of reasonable hatred, like, how dare he? What does he think he's doing? Grumble, grumble, grumble. Then right there is the image of the saw, and recognizing the standard set by the Buddha. So even if they're cutting your arms and legs off with a saw, it's still unjustifiable to dwell in aversion, to abide in that negativity. And if those negative feelings arise, then we are aware of those and let them pass through, and rather find this quality of acceptance, of recognition. Well, here it is, whether I like it or not, this is the experience, making space for things. Now, in this, maybe the another thing to say about loving kindness is, oftentimes, if the mind is getting caught up in aversion, getting annoyed with being sleepy, the mind getting dull and fighting against dullness, or getting annoyed with the chattering thoughts, and then we notice that aversion, that negativity, or aversion to the sounds that are going on in the room, or to the weather, or whatever it might be. And we notice those habits of aversion or negativity. And so then, I'm supposed to be developing loving kindness. I have to get rid of this aversion and establish and be loving and kind instead. I have to get rid of this negativity and to instead have this open-hearted quality of acceptance. But and again, this, I found this is a very, very helpful teaching that Lumpur Sumedho often has emphasized over time. He said, rather than trying to climb over your negativity to get to a place where you have benevolence or kindness towards all things on the other side, instead, bring that quality of kindness towards your own negativity. So it's not just towards the person that you're sharing the room with. It's not just towards difficulties in the family or even the sensations in the body, but also a kindness towards your own aversion, a kindness towards your own restlessness, your own complaining, criticizing mind. Which again doesn't mean to say that we're justifying it and saying, oh, it's a wonderful thing, I'm sitting here complaining all day long. How marvelous, how beautiful. But we're saying, look, this is the habit my mind has. It loves to complain. It loves to criticize. It never feels happier than when it's got a good gripe. Wonderfully unrequitable irritation, something that a problem that's never going to go away, that I can resent continually. We can look at that feeling. We can notice that negativity and recognize, well, this is the habit of the mind to complain or to worry and to criticize. This is the habit that's here. So we're bringing that quality of acceptance, of non-contention, to even the negative, unwholesome mind states. And that acceptance is not condoning them. We're not trying to extend the mind's negativity or praise it or amplify it or justify it, but rather recognizing when we try to suppress or push away the negative, when we try to wipe out our anger or wipe out our chattering thoughts, when we try to force our complaining mind to shut up and be quiet, that very negativity, that aversion, makes it stronger. It strengthens, it empowers the unwholesome qualities of the mind. Vibhava tanha, the desire to get rid of that very desire, then strengthens, empowers the negative qualities of the mind. It creates the causes for more negativity. Whereas when there is a quality of acceptance, radical acceptance, there's metta for the ugly as well as the beautiful, the unwholesome as well as the wholesome, then we are removing the causes for negativity. We are accepting, oh, anger is a part of nature. Yes, it happens. Here it is. I don't have to follow it. I don't have to believe that, you know, that person is responsible for all of my suffering just because they breathe in that weird way. But I can recognize angry impulses arise. They come into being, they do their thing, they fade away. And that quality of acceptance then, that removes the causes. It helps to wear away the causes of negativity and reaction within ourselves. So in this way, we can, here at the beginning of the retreat, all of us are probably experiencing various different obstacles and difficulties, what are called the five hindrances. The Buddha enumerated these, the different experiences or habits of mind that obstruct samadhi and obstruct the qualities of clarity and peacefulness. And we even call them the hindrances, the nivarana, and that gives them a negative tone. And these are five in number. The first one is sense desire, kama raga. The second one is ill will, negativity, vipada. The third one is restlessness, udaccha kukuccha. And then the next one is dullness, tinamita. And the last one is doubt, vichikicca. So you might think, I've got all five. Collected the entire set. You know, what they call a multiple hindrance attack. But most of us tend to specialize in certain ones. And so we can, it's very natural for us to think, well, these are the hindrances. If only I wasn't so sleepy. Oh, my mind is so dull. It's just completely switched off. I'm just zoning out, you know, completely every sitting. Even during the walking, I'm dozing off, you know. Get to the end of my path and have a quick nap. It's happened to me before. Or maybe we're just, the mind is hopelessly restless, just dashing around here, there, and everywhere, and the body just twitching and unsettled. The mind caught up in sense desire, you know, just carried away, chasing after, fantasizing what the cooks have got on the menu for tomorrow. What the restaurant you're going to go to when the retreat's over in 2 weeks' time. So it's going to be a Wednesday now. What do they have on the menu in there? That bistro on Wednesday evening. See? Or planning your future with the true love of your life that you've seen across the other side of the shrine room, but haven't quite introduced yourself to yet. Sense desire, kama raga, it's like this, or vipada, or how you're going to wreak vengeance on that person who's ruining your retreat, is going to make this impossible to meditate. So we call them the hindrances, the nivarana, and so it can seem to have this reasonable aversion. If only I didn't have so much sense desire, if only I wasn't so restless or so dull or so consumed with doubt, then I could meditate. Then my mind would focus. Then I could have a good retreat. It's very, very easy, natural to relate to the hindrances in that way. And we're not saying that when the mind is clear and peaceful and focused and abundant, exalted, immeasurable, radiating loving kindness over the entire world. It's not that that is not enjoyable. Yeah, that's a very sweet and beautiful quality. But if we praise the sweet and the beautiful and the noble, and we blame and criticize and hate the unwholesome, then we are going to be spinning around the endless cycles of compulsion, the cycles of birth and death, chasing after hope and finding ourselves chasing after disappointment, following disappointment as well, that we are endlessly caught in those cycles of hope and disappointment, success and failure, getting it right, getting it wrong. And one very, very helpful teaching that Lumpur Liam, who's the abbot of Wat Pa Phong, Ajahn Chah's main monastery, the main monastery in Thailand of our community. He came here to visit last year. I think it was last year. And in the springtime. And there was a very interesting exchange one day when some people came to visit and were having a sort of Dhamma dialogue with him. And somebody asked, Lumpur, what was the most significant difficulty that you had in your practice? What was the biggest obstacle that was there for you during your training? And he thought for a moment and he said, well, in the past there used to be a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety. And he was sort of about to say a bit more on that, and he said, but you know, it's not really helpful to think in terms of these qualities being obstructions, being upasaka, kind of an obstacle or an obstruction or difficulties. Yeah, you can just see his whole sort of mind reframing it. Yeah, it's, you know, we can call it that, but actually, what we think of as obstacles or hindrances, problems, these are actually our very best teachers, because that's how we develop wisdom. That's how we develop spiritual strength. And the phrase he used, I forget the Thai, but the monk who was translating it said, he says, it's the way that you raise your game. Like, you know, if you're a football player and you're just going to be playing against sort of Great Gadsden A team, you know, you probably have to try very hard. You know. But if you're lined up against Manchester United or Real Madrid, you've got to raise your game. You have to draw upon resources that you don't necessarily know that you have. So this is the kind of phrase that he used, and the allusion that he made was that the difficulties that we have, they help us to raise our game and to find resources, develop strengths that otherwise we wouldn't be able to. And this was something that Ajahn Chah would often say as well, how when people would praise him for his wisdom, or he had an extraordinary ability to always be able to answer people's questions or help people to answer their own questions or come up with some particular kind of practice or approach that was uniquely tailored and fitting to the life and the situation of everybody who came to speak with him or ask him questions. And they'll say, yeah, Lumpur, it's amazing, you're so wise, you're so knowledgeable, you seem to understand, you know, people and the Dhamma teachings are so completely and comprehensively, you know, you must have spent years studying the suttas, you must know the Abhidhamma back to front, you must fully understand all, you know, Buddhist psychology, Buddhist philosophy, to be so comprehensively wise and astute to all human difficulties. And he said, nah. This is not that I've studied Abhidhamma at all. He says, if I have any wisdom, the reason why is because I had a huge amount of defilements. You know, a lot of obstacles. Yeah, I said I was used to be extremely angry, very reactive and violent. I was filled with lust, extremely restless, and of all of the hindrances that I experienced, then even stronger than all of these was doubt. My mind was always riddled with doubt, getting carried away in endless cycles of thought and confusion, and getting lost in my own ideas and uncertainties. I think the only one of the five hindrances that he didn't specialize in was dullness, because the other four were raging with such kind of volcanic intensity that dullness didn't really get a look in. So, but the other four, he featured heavily in his. They featured heavily in his world. So this is I would suggest, I put forward as a different way to frame our attitude towards the dullness that we experience, the mind being sleepy, or the mind filled with sense desire, or the mind filled with aversion. The experiences of restlessness, just agitation, the body wanting to get up and run out, and wanting to go somewhere, do something, anything. That rather than these being obstacles or problems, to reframe that and to see these as opportunities to develop particular spiritual skills. Oh, the habits, the quality of sense desire helps us to develop renunciation, nikamma, the paramita, the spiritual virtue of a renunciation. Aversion, bipada, helps us to develop kindness, compassion. Restlessness helps us to develop patience. Dullness helps us to develop the paramita, the virtue of energy, brightness of mind. And doubt helps us to develop wisdom, clarity, and understanding. So obviously you can't just snap your fingers and turn your dullness experiences into all-encompassing abundant energy and brightness of mind. You can't just decide, oh yes, I'll give up my anger. I'll use my anger to develop kindness. That's a good idea. And then suddenly the all of the tendencies towards anger and aversion are transformed. It's not that simple, as we know. But at least when those waves of anger and righteous indignation arise, then rather than just buying into it and believing in what it's saying, that this person or this experience is awful and bad and it shouldn't be that way, to at least to be able to take a step back and say, aha, now this is an opportunity to develop loving kindness, compassion, metta and karuna. When the mind is lost in dullness, sleepy, just drowsy, rather than resenting that or just being swept along by that and being burdened or embarrassed or irritated by that, to say, ah, now here's the challenge. This is the great challenge of how to develop energy. How can I bring forth energy? How can the mind be guided towards brightness and alertness? How can that be done? What's the way, the means that can be done? So in this respect, the hindrances are great friends. They are our teachers. And as I was saying yesterday evening, I think that rather than sort of me sitting up here with the microphone being the teacher, it's up to us as individuals, each one of us, to be our own teacher and to use the circumstances that we have, rather than thinking, oh, if only I wasn't so dull, then I could really practice. This dullness is getting in the way. Let dullness be what you learn from. If your mind is caught up in sense desire, it's constantly desiring, looking for things to have and to get and to become, then let sense desire be that which we learn from, that which teaches us. Similarly with all of the others, whether it's desire, aversion, restlessness, dullness, or doubt itself. Often just as the raising the suggestion that it can be seen in a different way, that makes a huge difference. Just to take a little step back from it and say, this is not intrinsically a problem, but even when you say, this is not a problem, this is an interesting difficulty. It's an interesting challenge. You know, part of us says, ha! Good luck! and so it can seem like very, you know, wishful thinking or sort of a very sort of Buddhist thought. and yet the effect of simply doing that, just reframing the way that a particular pattern of experience or feeling is held, even though part of us really is struggling and is really overwhelmed or carried away, when we say, well, this is an interesting challenge, this is something to learn from, even though part of us might say, ha, yeah, good luck, likely story, part of us also says, yeah, right, that's true. There is a truth in that. Now, maybe this current of feeling, this the strength of the aversion or the strength of the desire is such that we feel totally swept away. But even as we're being swept away on that current, that outflow, there is that small quiet presence, that quality of mindfulness and wisdom that says, whoa, this is a strong one. I'm really getting caught up in this. You know, look at this one go. So this is not justifying or saying, okay, it's fine to be swept along by that surge of anger or that desire or that getting swamped by a feeling of dullness. But what you're doing is you're recognizing this is what's happening right now, and in the Buddha's teaching on the foundations of mindfulness, this is, for me, I find it's one of the most essential elements of that teaching, is in the third section of the Satipatthana Sutta. It's called Jitanupassana, which is a contemplation of moods or mind states. And this is, I feel, is an extraordinarily important, helpful teaching. And in this section, so for those of you who are not familiar, the first section of the Satipatthana, the foundations of mindfulness, is about mindfulness of the body, kayanupassana. The second one is about mindfulness of feeling, vedananupassana. So the third one is chittanupassana. So it's talking about the moods and mind states. And there's this very unique way that the Buddha talks about this in this sutta. And he says, to know the expanded mind, open and expansive mind as expanded. To know the contracted mind is contracted. You know, to know the agitated mind is agitated. To know the calm mind as calm. To know the mind filled with anger as filled with anger. And to know the mind free of anger as being free of anger. You know, to know the mind filled with sense desire is filled with sense desire, the mind free from sense desire is free from sense desire, and so on through this whole list, I think, of 16 different pairs of qualities. Now, in each one of those, he never says that anger is bad or that freedom from anger is good. In that particular teaching, that there's no moral judgment, there's no ranking of those experiences. He said that to establish mindfulness, So to even just to the extent of knowing there is this. This is the feeling of anger. This is the presence of restlessness. Here is the feeling of contractedness, tightness. Here is a feeling of expansiveness. Here is a feeling of love, of freedom from aversion. Here is the quality of stillness, quietness. So this is he said that to in this teaching. He said this is the extent that you need to establish mindfulness, just to know here is this quality, and in that simple awareness, that clear knowing. Okay, this is the feeling of anger. That which knows the anger is not angry. That which knows restlessness is not restless. That which knows worry is not worried. That makes sense? So what we're doing in this is recognizing that there's the object, the particular tone or quality of mind is one thing, and that which is aware of it is another. These are separate qualities. And in this particular teaching, it's a simple description. But in this, there's an enormously valuable principle is being described. So again, it's not condoning anger or saying, you know, having a contracted mind or agitated mind is a good and wonderful thing. But where the quality of agitation is known, in a sense, there's a taking refuge in that which is not agitated. There's a refuge in the knowing, in the awareness. And then to that degree, then that agitation is going on, but the heart is not entangled in it. It's not caught up. It's not overwhelmed by that. Now, as our days unfold and we have our time together, and we'll probably all of us be experiencing times of clarity and expansion and peacefulness, stillness, and times of agitation, times of anxiety or irritation, times of like and dislike, where the mind is caught in its preferences, and other times when the mind is very clear and unconfused. But in this teaching, as I was saying, that there's no in establishing mindfulness, you're not identifying with the good and rejecting the bad. You're not attaching to goodness and rejecting and dismissing badness, but rather recognizing, you know, wholesome qualities feel like this, unwholesome qualities feel like this, and the development of wisdom, the development of insight, is learning to, in a sense, separate out the mind state and that which knows the mind state. And this is the essence, this separating out, this dissociating or disentangling, is the essence of vipassana meditation. Insight meditation is this letting go of the habits of identification. So rather than thinking, I am angry, or I am peaceful, I am concentrated, I am distracted. In this disentangling, this letting go, this sort of separating out of the awareness from the object, it's seeing very directly, oh, there is agitation, or there is stillness, there is anger, there is kindness, there is expansiveness, there is contractedness. That's not me, it's not mine, it's not who and what I am, it's just a pattern of nature coming and going and changing. Now this insight was one of the most important teachings that Ajahn Chah received from Ajahn Mun. He considered himself to be Ajahn Mun's disciple and a student of his and a follower of his way, but he only ever spent about 3 days with Ajahn Mun. And when people asked him, well, why didn't you stay any longer? He says, well, when the light comes on, you know, you don't need to stay near the switch, you know. or words to that effect. I think there wasn't any electricity in what Nong Pu, but that was the kind of analogy that once you've lit the candle, you don't have to walk around with a matchbox in your hand. So that this particular teaching on the mind and its objects being intrinsically separate from each other, this was something that Ajahn Mun made very, very clear to Ajahn Chah. He said how in the normal circumstances of things, our mind is identified with its moods, with its objects. We think, I'm concentrated, I'm alert, I'm peaceful, I'm angry, I'm agitated, I'm afraid. It's completely ordinary, unremarkable. But he pointed out that actually the mind which knows and the moods that are known, these are intrinsically separate, and that when you allow the mind to settle, when you are able just to loosen that habit of attachment, then that quality of awareness, that quality of awakened knowing, on account of its own nature, separates out, loosens the grip on the object. And Ajahn Chah would use the analogy of oil and water mixed together in a bottle. So if the bottle's always been shaken around, like you've got oil and water in it, if the bottle's always agitated and being shaken up, then it seems like the oil and the water are one liquid, they're one substance. Because they're being, you're used to them being together. But they're only together because of the agitation of the bottle. If you put the bottle down, then the oil and the water separate out from each other. You don't have to do the separating. You don't have to make the water and the oil leave each other. Because of their different densities, their different qualities, they separate out on their own. This is the kind of teaching that Ajahn Mun gave him. Said, if you just leave it alone, if you just let go of the habitual attachments and the habits of identification and entanglement, if you just put the bottle down, then the quality of knowing, of awakened awareness, it separates out from the object. And so then in that, there's a we see that this is the essence of why freedom is possible, or why liberation is possible, because they say that the mind which knows, the mind which is aware, is not intrinsically tied to all the comings and goings, the successes and failures, the gains and losses that happen through our life and through our being, but rather it's that which is receiving them, knowing them, is not limited by any experience. Just like a mirror reflects with complete impartiality whatever you put in front of the mirror, it reflects it. It doesn't say, oh well, I don't want to, I'll give you an image of dark haired people, but don't put any redheads in front of the mirror. I refuse to reflect the light from a redhead. Only blonde-haired people and dark-haired people. I don't do redheads. It's ridiculous. It doesn't happen that way. Mirrors don't function like that. They just reflect the light impartially. So in the same way, the mind which is aware is completely impartial, and it's that. That kind of separating out, that letting go, that disentanglement is the essence of what Vipassana meditation is about, and is why we have the potential to be free. Now that freedom does not bring with it an irresponsibility. It's not like, not me, not mine, all dhammas are not self, nothing belongs to me, nothing is my responsibility, I'm practicing non-attachment, You do the dishes, you know. You can tidy the room, you know. Yeah. Nothing is mine, you know. That's called stupidity. It's a technical... It's grasping the idea of non-attachment, or grasping the idea of not-self, because the twin, or the partner of the quality of awareness or knowing, of vicha in Pali, is the quality of charana. Like in the chanting that we do, we say impeccable in knowledge and conduct. And it's the English translation for the words vicha charana sampanno. So along with vicha, its partner is that of charana. So the quality of vicha, or knowing, is the transcendent element, and charana is the immanent, that which is, the way that quality of awareness manifests in the world is in conduct. Charana literally means to walk. Charity means to walk, or to go, to fare. And so you can't really have the vijja without the charana, I would say. And the two are a partnership. They go together, just like you say the immanent quality of Dhamma, the here and now, manifest quality of reality is part of it, and then also the transcendent element, the liberated quality of Dhamma is also present. You can't get the immanent without the transcendent. They're a partnership. So similarly, when there is this letting go, this non-attachment, it doesn't make us into a kind of spaced out zombie, like somehow unable to function in the world, or not taking responsibility. There's a mysterious way when we establish this quality of wisdom, of awareness, and letting go of the world completely. In letting go of all things, we, in that very gesture of letting go, we find ourselves more fully attuned to all things. Again, this might sound completely contradictory or weird, but like I was saying last night about my experience with walking around Mount Kailash, you know, there's the present immanent quality of everything happening here. It's completely personal. The reality of the present moment is experienced here, this body, this life, in this spot. This is where it's felt. This is the it's experienced personally. And the Buddha would even use this kind of language to say that when a being is enlightened, it's that they are personally liberated. It happens in the sphere of their life. This being is liberated, not that one. It's happening here. But at the same time, it's non-personal. So I apologize if this sounds confusing or complicated. But I think it's an important principle to understand that along with that transcendent quality of vijja, that aspect of wisdom, which is completely unattached, that which is utterly beyond the world, which is non-material, is not tied to the five khandhas, not tied to the body or feelings, perceptions, to the sense world, is totally transcendent of it. Its partner is charana, the way that non-attachment, that non-entanglement manifests, is through acutely mindful and attentive action and speech. So, and then this is borne out in the example of the stories of the Buddha's life, and that even though he was totally enlightened, fully self-awakened Buddha, completely not attached, completely liberated, utterly unconfined by any thought or feeling, any material limitation. Every single word that he spoke, from the time of his enlightenment until the parinibbana, the end of his life in the human world, every word that he spoke was perfectly attuned to the time, the place, the situation was perfectly appropriate. that every action that he carried out was in tune with the beings that were around him, and that the quality of care and respect, the quality of kindness and compassion, the quality of, say, attunement to the time, the place, the situation was extraordinarily acute. He was every action was as finely formed as like the grains of the purest flour. But his at the same time internally, his heart was completely unattached, unentangled, yeah, to any particular thing. Now that seems difficult to do. Well, either you really care and you're really involved and you're fully with what's going on, or you're detached. You've let go. You don't care. But the in a way, the middle way, I would say, is exactly that, both totally present and totally gone. fully attuned to the here and now, to the every action, every gesture, every word, every movement, and internally, in terms of attitude, fully released, unconfined, unfettered, unburdened by every thought or feeling or perception. So even though that sounds mysterious or hard to imagine, I would suggest this is what is the goal of Buddhist practice, and what the middle way points to. This is the mysterious middle. And it's also, as I like to point out, this is borne out in the word that the Buddha used to refer to himself. He seems to have coined the word Tathagata as a term to refer to himself. And for 25 centuries, people have been debating what exactly Tathagata means. Because it's got two parts. Tat, T-A-T-H, or tata, means thus or such. And the word gata means to go, like Buddhang Saranam Gacchami, I go to the Buddha for refuge. Gata means to go. Agata means to come. The A at the beginning is a negative. So people have been debating, literally for 2.5 centuries, is it tat agata, one thus come, one who has come to suchness, arrived at suchness, at thusness, or is it tata gata, one who has gone to suchness? Is the Buddha fully present? Is he fully attuned or with the manifest world? Is he here? Is the Buddha totally here, or is he totally gone? Thus gone or thus come? And throughout the teachings, if you've studied the Pali Canon, particularly if you know a little bit of Pali, you become aware that the Buddha was very fond of puns and word plays. This might not be apparent. It might not seem like the Pali Canon is a bundle of laughs and wisecracks, but apparently it is. In many of the English translations, miss those double meanings. But the Buddha was very fond of these kind of word plays. And my pet theory that I feel is relevant here is that he deliberately chose an ambiguous word, and that it's supposed to both mean thus come and thus gone, completely here and completely gone, utterly present and totally transcendent. And so there is an ambiguity, there's a kind of ironic mixture there. So the thinking mind is like, well, is it here, is it gone? It's either present or it's transcendent. But I feel that the Buddha was trying to use a term, or brought forth a term that carried both those meanings, and that this is the Buddha principle, that this is both fully liberated, unentangled, and transcendent, but yet also participating, fully attuned, engaged with, you know, the time, the place, the situation, and the material world. So I think that's enough for you all to reflect upon for this evening. So as usual, whatever is helpful, then please take it and use it. Whatever is not, then just leave it aside. Amen.